Take a network break. Hold on tight to your virtual donuts as we dash through this week's tech news. We've got stories on Riverbed, Dell, Intel, and many more. I'm Drew Conry-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. But before we get started, just a couple of sponsor messages. This episode of Network Break is being brought to you by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and a limited time, you can get 50% off the monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Just visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK50. This week's show is also sponsored by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. It's taking place May 15th through the 19th, 2017. You can get a year's worth of objective IT education in just 1 week. Visit interopitx.com, use the promo code PacketPushers, and get a 20% discount. And last but not least, if you're attending Interop, you're invited to a live gathering at the Centrifuge Lounge at the MGM in Las Vegas to join Viptela and the PacketPushers and your networking peers for a live event. We'll have food, drink, and great conversation. That's happening Monday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. Please register at viptela.com/centrifuge, and we'll see you there. All right, getting into the news, our first story, Riverbed is buying the wireless vendor Xeris.
So Xeris is one of those wireless vendors that's been around for a long time. We've seen a lot of shakeout in the wireless space over the last year or so, haven't we? We've seen Ruckus go to Brocade, and then Brocade funneled off when Broadcom bought them to Aris, that's right. We saw Aruba go to HP. We saw Meraki go to Cisco 2 or 3 years ago. So there's been a whole consolidation phase in the wireless business across the board. What's interesting about this, I think, in a couple of different ways, is that this really puts the branch network on a different footing. So there's a couple of different ways to look at this. Perhaps one of them is that Riverbed is now a networking company. Before, they used to be the WAN accelerator and a load balancer and some monitoring systems. And now they're very much focusing on the SD-WAN as a way out. Would you agree with that?
100%, yes. They are a networking company.
Yeah, and they've very much on this SD-WAN, and they've bought a company out of Germany.
It was called Ocedo. Yeah, and the interesting thing about Ocedo is that Riverbed got some SD-WAN technology out of Ocedo, but Ocedo also had a line of campus and branch APs and switches, so they, I think they were dipping the toe in their water there on being a campus or branch player.
Yeah, so I think what you're seeing here, and it's becoming fairly obvious too that this is across the board, the idea that the branch network is something that's like there's the branch LAN and then there's the branch WAN, and they're two different things, that's pretty much sort of finished. It's going to be LAN and WAN, one box. And they're all part of the SD-WAN. So that is your entire branch networking from the LAN to the WAN to the overlay to the head office is all going to be managed by your SD-WAN appliance. Or that's what they're going to try and sell us.
Yeah.
So you'll have these switches that are integrated with the WAN SD-WAN edge device. And that SD-WAN edge device will have WAN acceleration and firewalls and proxy servers and content engines and print and all that stuff will be in the WAN edge box. So your idea of your WAN router just forwarding packets is so yesterday.
Passé. Merely routing packets.
And this isn't an innovation by any stretch of the imagination. If you want to say it's an innovation, have a look at what Cisco Meraki business unit is doing. The Meraki team, sort of famously not being part of Cisco while being part of Cisco, of course, has been doing exactly this. They've been treating the whole branch network as a completely integrated thing. You buy and managed by a cloud platform. So I think Riverbed has sort of got a hold of Ocedo, worked out what they could do with SD-WAN, what they could do with their existing software and their knowledge and all the portfolio that they've got. And then they've gone, you know, look, what we really need to be doing here is making out some switches. And of course, now they can build switches with Whitebox that'll work perfectly fine in a branch. You don't need to spend billions building up an infrastructure design a switcher and stock it. You can just use some white box and put in some nice color scheme on the metalwork.
Well, Xeris actually has a couple of switches in its portfolio too. They've got a couple of campus boxes already. So.
Yeah, my understanding of Xeris is, and I might be wrong here, I'm no Wi-Fi expert, so it's difficult to track the Wi-Fi industry, but Xeris's claim to fame in the Wi-Fi space was they had some fancy multi-antenna stuff. And over time, that antenna capability has been sort of degraded as beamforming. A lot of those features are now folded into the 802.11 standards. So, you know, they used to run 12 antennas or 24 antennas when other people were running one. And this multi-antenna apparently gave them an edge. But I think what you're seeing in wireless, of course, is that there's now standard merchant silicon chipsets for wireless base stations that most wireless companies use. So I can't remember exactly who it is, but most of the vendors don't actually make their own silicon. They just go and buy a chipset from Broadcom or a chipset from Atheros, if I remember rightly. And then the features are in the antennas that they design for you. And the software that runs on those chipsets to decode the signals. And in the same way that any operating system on a white box router has to be innovative, reliable, and the features that you want are in the software. The hardware is pretty much all the same across all the wireless things. And so it makes sense for Riverbed to say, what we want to do is we want to own all the branch, all the WAN, the SD-WAN, the whole bit. We're not going to own the data center, but we can own the branch campus network and get into there. So that makes sense to me. We know that the SDN control of that can be done because Cisco Meraki's been doing that. What are they, $750 million a year or something now?
Not sure.
We've talked about them a couple of times. But, I mean, that has been a huge success for Cisco. They bought them for not much money, and then it's turned into a massive cash flow, huge growth. Every quarter, Meraki comes in with, like, huge numbers. So there. So I think it's, you know, this mix of merchant silicon allows Riverbed to easily access new hardware. You're seeing software-defined or software SDN, this idea of centrally controller-driven networks, whether from the cloud or from your old controller, to manage your WAN, the software-defined WAN, which we've been talking about for more than 2 years now. And now what we're saying is, well, why don't I just bring my branch LAN and my branch services, you know, my WAN accelerators and firewalls and blah, 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 and bring them all together into a single controller-driven platform. And this makes perfect sense to me.
And then you've got that ability to manage with the cloud your SD-WAN boxes, now maybe your switches, and also your access points, and perhaps doing some kind of integration with SD-WAN with their application and policy control, bringing that more into the branch side to get more visibility or do more kinds of policy control and tweaking QoS on the actual applications running inside the branch, perhaps. That may be the long-term story.
Yeah, well, yes, you get right into seeing putting in the user authentication right out to the Ethernet port and the Wi-Fi port in the branch would dramatically change everything, and integrating that to the WAN. That makes sense. It's really interesting that the new Riverbed doesn't look anything like the old Riverbed, does it?
Not at all. Not at all.
It was taken private about 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in private, it's a VC funded or venture capital, not venture capital, but, you know, private investors. And they've really been willing to take some risks with this and build a networking company that's going to take Cisco head on, I think.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how the branch is suddenly revitalizing and becoming a real focus of interest and maybe even some innovation here.
You know, it'd be really fun to see is some research on how many routers in the branch network are up for renewal. I have a sense that a lot of what's in customers' WANs is like more than 10 years old. They're not changing it because they don't have to, sort of thing. I do wonder, it'd be interesting to see some data about that.
And maybe see a dip in branch routers as a rise in SD-WAN devices goes up?
Well, I think it's a chance. I think it's pretty interesting that if you're running a 3,000 node network, you're probably frightened to go and upgrade it because you've got these routers you brought 10 years ago. You might have replaced a few, but you know that's so much painful to replace them. Cisco equipment is usually very difficult to replace. You've got a massive buying process that's going to suck up, you know, months of your time. And then you've got to go out to every one of your 3,000 sites to install this new kit. You need to have a better ROI than my router is obsolete.
Sure, you know what I mean? Exactly.
And I do wonder how many companies are just sitting there going, yeah, we know we should do something, but we're not going to do it this year because there's no reason to change it. It's working fine as it is. There's no value. Whereas this sort of stuff that Riverbed's putting together, and, you know, and Meraki and, you know, Viptela and Versa and all the SD-WAN companies are sort of moving in this area at different levels. You know, you're saying to yourself, I could increase my totally addressable market by just adding some Wi-Fi. You know, maybe you even just start building a Wi-Fi base station into your SD-WAN edge device, right? Put a couple of antennas on it, a bit of chip inside. It's all driven by the fact it's easy to get the silicon. Anybody can have Wi-Fi silicon. Get yourself some software from a wireless company, and pretty soon thereafter, 6 months to a year, you've got yourself a branch wireless system.
Yeah, everybody wants to own the branch now.
Mm. And then you can suddenly, you know, now you're sitting in front of the CIO saying, well, we know your gear is old, but here's what we can do to make you want to run this project. What we're going to do is we're going to take your whole branch and revolutionize it so that the whole cost of running it is changed.
Right. It's not just an upgrade. You're doing a whole value add.
Yeah. You're not just keeping the same as what you've already got. You're saying I can reduce the cost of ownership or add value or something like that.
Yeah. Well, this is something we're going to keep an eye on because I think it is a sign of how the branch is becoming a renewed focused in owning it. Let's move on though. Microsoft, they recently purchased a company called Deis. They make open source tools to help manage Kubernetes. And we all know Kubernetes is the popular container orchestration software. Microsoft bought the company from Engine Yard, which itself acquired Deis back in 2015. And I think the play here, Microsoft is hoping to bolster Azure as a container platform. So they acquire some Kubernetes chops. That's a step in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been watching some of the cloudarati go backwards and forwards on Kubernetes this week and cloud and public cloud. And I think the big thing here at the moment is that AWS hasn't latched onto Kubernetes. There's a lot of people, you know, it's all very fashionable lately to say, oh, containers and Kubernetes is definitely going to win this war. And all of a sudden, we're starting to see a big pushback because Kubernetes actually is quite difficult to use. It's not enterprise ready. In other words, it's not for stupid people, is what, you know, when you read between the lines of what they're saying, you know, you need to be smart to make Kubernetes go and things like this. I do struggle a little bit with these people in the cloud are now sort of developing this reverse snobbery about, you know, like, well, you know, containers are a cloud workload. You couldn't possibly use it. You know, you couldn't understand them unless you're in the cloud like us, you know, sort of thing. And so it's interesting that Microsoft is now acquiring this to run containers instead of just saying, well, why don't we do Kubernetes? You know, is Deus a version of Kubernetes?
It sounds like it's some tools to help you manage Kubernetes. So, yeah, it's not a competitor to Kubernetes. It's an add-on.
Now, see, it's funny how Kubernetes is not a magic wand anymore.
Well, I was thinking like, wait, I need something to help me run. Isn't Kubernetes helping me run something else? What? How many layers are we going down?
This sounds like OpenStack. You mean OpenStack is hard because you're doing like this lots of really complicated stuff? And we'll talk more about that in a minute, I know.
Yeah, a little preview we've got coming up.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the point is that, yeah, running Kubernetes is hard in the same way that building a bare metal cloud like you do in your enterprise today is hard. And running a VMware vRealize is hard. Why is this a surprise to people? Really? Honestly?
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise. I think there's a lot of stories told about, you know, the ease of cloud. And when you start getting into it, it's not quite that easy.
Yes, that's definitely true. You'll run into a wall of, you know, whatever. And yeah, sure.
All right, moving on, a little note about Barracuda. Their stock price dropped more than 16% after the company recorded their fourth quarter earnings. They reported $89.3 million in revenue, which was up 7% over last year. The problem is that they saw a decline in subscription renewals, a little dip of 3%, but that was enough to send some analysts scurrying.
Yeah, so no big deal, you'd think. You know, subscription renewals, it could be a signature of customers who are leaving the company. That is, they're no longer using their Barracuda products and heading off to somewhere else. So is that a symbol of customers going to the cloud? Is that a symbol of customers switching out of Barracuda products to someone else's products? Or is it a symbol that Barracuda is not in the cloud? And in particular, one of the things about this is that renewals is very, very much of a big problem. Every single time that Chuck Robbins gets onto a call with Cisco, he's going like, our subscription revenues are up 2%. Funny and weirdly, it's always up 2% every quarter. Not more, not less. Just enough to... I always found that a little bit interesting. You know, this renewal rate, the subscription renewal rate, is often seen by investors as a measure of how cloud, of the transition to the cloud. Now, a lot of investors don't have time to go deep into what a company's doing. You know, they might be invested in 20 different market segments. So they latch on to some fairly simplified metrics about the success or failure of publicly listed companies, which Barracuda is. One of them is this idea is that subscription revenue is a key measure in, is the company going to make the transition to the cloud or not? And a lot of companies' subscription revenue is just hardware maintenance, software maintenance. And now to fund subscription services, Barracuda has started to provide cloud malware and cloud virus scanning services as the same way that F5 has and Riverbed and all the other companies who've got anything attached to the internet have now got a cloud security service in the back end, blah, blah. And that's a per yearly charge for that service. And that's seen as cloudifying. So if Barracuda doesn't match that key metric of growing recurring subscription revenue from services in some way, then you want to get out of that stock and move your shares mostly to Cisco because Cisco is paying a whacking great dividend these days.
Well, I should note that Barracuda, they more than 3/4 of their revenue comes from subscriptions. So I guess these analysts were saying that's to see that dip when it's such a core part of their income. I guess there was a little heading for the hills.
Yeah. I didn't have a time to get through their slides because I've been struggling with, you know, with health issues this week, but I think it might have also been like flat sales. So it's fine for subscriptions to decline if you've sold a whole lot of new product or you've got, you know, 10% growth in sales. But I think they might have just been flat, which sort of indicates that something else has gone wrong.
Well, actually, they had a decent fiscal year. Their total revenue was up 10% over the prior year, and even their quarter was up. But I guess, again, it's that little dip that because some of these analysts are so tied to that subscription metric that any little ding, they're going to hurt you.
Yep. Yep. All of the IT companies are being, all of the legacy IT companies, so that is the people who used to sell you boxes, box shifting. Cisco, Juniper, blah, 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 they're all there. They're all being radically measured on all the usual metrics, but recurring revenue is a big one. So you'll see this much more often in the year ahead.
All right, moving on to Intel. They are pulling funding from the OpenStack Innovation Center. That's a partnership they launched with Rackspace back in 2015. And the goal there was to develop OpenStack for the enterprise. According to the agreement, Intel and Rackspace were going to provide engineers and code, fix bugs, add features, and perform testing and all that. A story in Fortune says that Intel had originally pledged to fund this project through 2018, but they pulled the funding early.
Yeah. You know, do you ever feel like a lot of things in IT go through this like fashion? And it's like, you know, does my bum look big in this OpenStack outfit?
And apparently the answer is yes.
Apparently for Intel, the answer is yes. Not only Intel, by the way, Cisco, HP, of course, many other companies have pulled out of the OpenStack effort over the last year or two when they've sort of realized that it's not going to produce short-term results. I think there's several things here. You know, many vendors jumped into OpenStack back in the day because they thought it was going to be a way to defend against public cloud. If only we could build a private cloud solution that everybody could get behind. Everybody would put OpenStack on top of their existing hardware and the public cloud would go away and everybody would go back to where they were. Except public cloud actually was a very strong competitor. It offers customers things that they actually want. And the, you know, Cisco and HP and IBM have not been able to compete against the public cloud yet. They still haven't put together, in my opinion, any sort of a reaction to it. But OpenStack was the one. And they all sort of ran into OpenStack with fistfuls of cash and hundreds of developers going, yes, we're all in with OpenStack. Now, what are we going to do? And then, of course, they just left the underlings to go and sort themselves out in a project. And then all of the vendor employees promptly decided that, well, I'm from Cisco, so I'd better get into the networking and make a Cisco networking piece. You know, and there was all these people pulling in all these different, and the project bloated out. These people were all doing the right thing for the right reasons. I'm not criticizing them. It's just like, instead of the vendors pulling together to produce a stripped down private cloud that would just run ES as stage one, and then the other stuff would come later, they blew it up like a massive bloated balloon. And so they forked it and branched it, and there were sub projects, and you know, there was confusion, code guidelines were being ignored. And then they decided the OpenStack community expanded so much that they tried to support every single use case. And of course, every vendor that comes along imagined its own use case and product managers and so forth. And ultimately, in all of this confusion, public cloud just kept right on going. So, you know, and the public cloud went in a single direction while open source was wandering around and OpenStack was changing its mind every other week and deciding what it was going to be like and what features to support and how many different modules. And then they came up with OpenStack Core, but not everybody wanted to support OpenStack Core because every vendor wanted to make sure that its piece of the pie was in the OpenStack Core. And then, of course, all this confusion then fed into what customers were doing because they lacked the competency to understand buying open source and the ownership decisions for building a private cloud. So it seems to me that OpenStack will continue. I doubt if it's pulled out completely. It'll continue to contribute at some level. But I would say that OpenStack needs to just some more time to mature. I maintain that OpenStack seems likely to be the long-term future of the private cloud, but it'll come out of carriers. So what AT&T is doing with Cord, C-O-R-D, or Onos is much more likely to be the direction. So, you know, this makes sense. These companies aren't relevant to OpenStack now, and actually we might be better off if they weren't in it.
I was actually just thinking that as you were talking about the way that having big money vendors is sort of a blessing and a curse for these open source projects because they can contribute code and they can contribute engineers and staff, but they also want to pull it in a particular direction, which may not be the best for the whole project overall. And so maybe having folks like Intel says they're still going to contribute, but maybe if their role is reduced, then it's better in the long run for OpenStack. I agree with you there that I think OpenStack over the long term has a role to play. It's just that they've bitten off so much in this project to try to bring private cloud into the data center. You think about how long it took for Linux to mature to become a production operating system that folks are very comfortable with. OpenStack is that plus, you know, storage plus networking plus a bunch of other orchestration components. That's hard to do.
Yes, that's right. It is hard to do, and keeping all those people together and, you know, naturally the corporate overlords are saying, well, what are you, you know, I've given you 50 engineers or 100 engineers. What are you giving me back? Where's the results for this? And you're sort of going like, that's 5 years down the track, son.
Yeah, or 10. But when you're talking about a Cisco or an HPE and they're pouring money in, they want to see faster results, and you're not going to get it with a project of this scope in an open source format.
Exactly. And that's what they misunderstood about open source is that why is it suddenly when big companies throw resources at an open source project, they expect quarterly results. when their internal projects don't even do that, right? You know, look at NCEMI. That took 5 years to go from woe to go. So why was it perfectly acceptable to put, you know, $700 million into NCEMI over a five-year period, but $50 million into OpenStack had to turn a result in 2 years? And the lack of grown-up behavior, of course, a community-driven project or a consensus-driven project actually has to have grown-ups able to compromise and to give and take. And of course, these companies are all tuned to hate each other and compete. There has to be a winner and a loser. And there are no winners in open source communities. Everybody gets something, you know, it's a shared win. There's shared losses. And that's not something the corporate mindset can get. And so getting the right people into these open source projects with the right mindset and setting the right expectations, and it may be that OpenStack dies in the long term, but at least companies like the big companies who were involved might have learned some lessons about how to participate the right way in an open source project.
Right.
There was a really good discussion on Hacker News on news.y Combinator. I'll link to it, where there's a good discussion of about 100 different comments that sort of picks out lots of different people's personal views ultimately, and but people who were involved with it and to why OpenStack is funny. This doesn't mean that OpenStack is over. Like I said, I still think that OpenStack will be the long-term successor in the private cloud, not because it's the best, but because there's nothing else. And it's going to be where we're going to see it in the end. And this is just probably actually healthy for it to get some of the dead wood out.
Well, we'll see. And OpenStack is something we're going to be coming back to more and more. We're going to have more Intel news, but first, a brief message from our sponsor, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you'll get access to the most important tools that you need to prepare for your IT certification. They've got over 2,000 hours of content and more than 125 hours of content streaming live every single week. You can stream these courses live and, of course, on demand from their website. You can watch it on a Chromecast, a Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, or your computer. Upcoming course topics include Office 365, Sierra Update, Let's Encrypt, and Greg, this is one for you, the ITIL SOA and ITIL PPO. I know you love your ITIL.
Oh, come on, please, please. If you've got to do ITIL for your job, sure, but otherwise, run away.
And if video's not enough, transcripts let you follow from start to finish or jump off at any point in the video. You can take advantage of their low monthly subscription price and a no-hassle cancellation policy. And IT Pro TV has introduced a new standard membership level that gives you access to all the live and recorded video content only. Then there's the premium annual membership, which includes all the video content as well as access to virtual labs and Q&A forums. The cost is normally $85.70 a month or $857 a year, but we've got a special offer for our Network Break listeners. For a free 7-day trial and for a limited time, 50% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription, just visit itpro.tv/networkbreak. And use the code NETWORKBREAK50, that's NETWORKBREAK50. Go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK50. And thanks, IT Pro TV, for being a sponsor. All right, back to the news. We promised some more Intel stories. They are shuttering a business unit and getting rid of the Intel Developers Forum.
Yeah, the Intel Developer Forum is a conference that, full disclosure, we've been to a couple of times as a guest of the Intel. And every year I've been, I've learned a phenomenal amount, particularly in 2014 when I got a whole bunch of like inside details on what the x86 and that the x86 networking was going to be awesome. And again, in 2016, when I got a second invitation. So I'm more than a little bit crushed that this has happened. Normally, this conference is actually held in August, so it's a little late to cancel, don't you think? These conferences don't normally cancel right. Just a few months out. Yeah.
Yeah, it's odd. And the fact that these developer forums, you see them, you know, most of the major companies will have one. I think Amazon is having one right now or just a couple of days ago before we recorded. Salesforce does it, Apple does it, Google does it, all of the big companies, because it's not only a way to bring folks together and get some excitement about what you're up to, but it does pull back the kimono a little bit and provide some really exciting and interesting detail into what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've really got a lot of great data out of that, and I'm sort of sad that I'm not going to get access to the insights of what's happening with x86, and I'm trying to think about, you know, how am I going to get access to, you know, good detailed information, because it was a really great forum for that. But on the other hand, the conference never sort of struggled to get on the map. Like, it never really got traction in terms of the map of conferences. They always sort of tried to have it when it was up against Cisco and VMware and the Oracle. Like, if you're going to hold an event, don't hold it in August in San Francisco when everybody else's events are in. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, Cisco Live, and then there's VMware, VMworld in August. And why didn't these people think about, why don't you pick a time of the year when everybody's not rushing around from conference to conference, so it's actually possible to attend. But I also think that maybe Intel's refocusing itself for the new era. You know, the x86 is struggling. You know, AMD's got some, we've seen Intel under threat in lots of different places. And it's had a golden decade when it was unchallenged and everything it did got right. You know, it got the right silicon. It built great memory modules. And then in this last 12 months, we've seen the 3D XPoint, the three-dimensional 3D NAND stumble. It didn't come out quite on time and the performance hasn't quite been there. Its dominance in the data center has been a little bit threatened by ARM CPUs and the server and the megascale data center customers are starting to flex their buying muscles and say, you should start doing things our way. And so Intel can't dictate the market. And so maybe what we're seeing here is a sort of a refocus on the core aspects of what Intel's doing and doing less of the community outreach as a face-to-face. And quite honestly, a reduction in conferences and doing more over the internet is actually quite welcome, I think.
It's true. You could spend pretty much the whole year going from conference to conference. And so maybe that had something to do with it. And there does seem to be a bit, we just talked about Intel pulling out of OpenStack. And now Intel is shutting down this developer conference and this next story where they're shutting down their Lustre file system business. There does seem to be a bit of a retrenchment, a refocus. Let's focus on some key areas and maybe do a little re-strategization.
Focus down on the things that maybe matter to them, or maybe cut a few budgets. And, you know, maybe there's a little bit of fat crept in over 10 years of success.
I can imagine, yes. When the money pours in, that's when the pounds start to get added.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Does my bum look big in this? Does my budget look big in this? I think we've got a theme for the show.
I guess we do. I'm feeling a little self-conscious.
So this also relates to the Lustre file system business. So Intel has been building a scale-out storage system as well for the last, decade or so. It was one of the first scale-out storage products to be out there, which is software that runs on x86. And Intel shut down its Lustre file system business. It's basically been killed off. Another sign that budgets don't fit and they're looking for places. Now, I do believe that Lustre as a scale-out storage product wasn't quite as successful as some competitors. That is, it was originally designed for high-performance compute and designed to be a petabyte scale. And I've spoken to a few people. I'm not a storage expert, so don't quote me here, but my understanding is that it just wasn't quite up to what the competition was doing. So I think that there are other systems. There's Gluster, there's Ceph, there's in the mid-tier of the market. And then you've got all the storage vendors all juking it out with hundreds of millions of dollars of venture capital money. Maybe it just didn't make sense for Intel to keep making storage products that compete with one of its best customers, aka the storage industry.
Absolutely. And you got to know here that the software is apparently being handed over to the Linux Foundation.
Yeah, so I've got a feel that the Linux Foundation is kind of like where you put your used condoms when you're finished with them. You know, so, wow, we've got this great business, and it's just all give it to open source and say to customers, well, it's open source. We did the best we could.
Yeah.
You know, like,
don't be mad at us. You can still have the software.
You can still have the software, but, you know, we're just not supporting it anymore. And I know that's not a very good metaphor, but it does really feel like, yep, handed it over to the Linux Foundation. Got rid of that problem. Ah, I do wonder if the Linux Foundation is actually going to be a repository of things that we don't want anymore for big corporate companies.
That's the land of forgotten toys.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. And the Linux Foundation sort of puts them on caretaker mode. And if anybody forgets about them, then it is the forgotten toy.
Put them on an iceberg and let them float away.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, that could be bad.
All right, moving on. Dell Technologies, they're selling their cloud backup business to a private equity company. The company they're selling is called Spanning. They provide backup services for cloud services like Office 365, Google G Suite, and Salesforce. The terms of the deal weren't disclosed. This Spanning was purchased by EMC back when EMC was still an independent company. Dell decided to get rid of it, although according to an article in Fortune, Dell will still resell Spanning services. It's just going to be handed over to a private equity company.
Does my company look big in this?
That's right. We do have a theme.
I think this Spanning is a multi-cloud orchestration piece, and obviously Dell wants to be an ARM supplier to the cloud. They don't want to be owning cloud. So we saw them sell off via vCloud Air this week. They've got a couple of other cloud businesses that they've been getting rid of, and this is another one.
Don't compete with your customers, you're saying?
I think so. I think that's part of it. You could call it a focus on your core business. You could call it, that's a nice bit of cash to help us pay down the $60 billion debt.
Yeah, speaking of does my bum look big, that debt does look big, and no amount of careful draping is going to help.
No, loose shirts and tying up your hair.
There is no shirt loose enough to cover that.
That's right. You can't just put a belt around that and make it look less. It's still a size 52 belt, anyway you look at it. So, I think this is about, you know, getting away from its customers. It doesn't want to be seen to be competing with the public clouds out there in the hope that Dell is able to make and sell them servers of a particular point. Let's just say that they're selling it because it makes sense to do so. It's consistent with what they've also been doing, but I'm sure that the cash had a big part of this.
Yeah, the terms of the deal weren't disclosed, so I'm guessing it wasn't a whole ton of cash, but enough to make a difference.
Hmm.
All right, and another quick break to talk about Interop ITX. This is a place where tech pros to get objective full-stack education. And Greg, the Packet Pushers are going to be at Interop. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening?
I can't wait to get there. Interop ITX, it's called this year. So if you called it Interop before, it's now called Interop ITX. And that's where you go to get a whole full-stack IT education. So it's not just about networking. It's right across the board. So the Interop conference is a little bit different from before. But you can join me and Ethan Banks for our Future of the Networking Summit, which is 2 days of networking goodness, where we deep dive into the next generation of WAN, data center, network ops, and software-defined security. So Ethan and I are going to be sort of giving you our unfiltered knowledge or expertise or vision of where we think this is going to go. And we've got some guests coming along to talk as well about to fill in the gaps and also give you a bit of a break from us droning on for an hour after hour, which would be nice for you. So you should definitely register for Interop ITX and attend our 2 days, the Future of Networking track. And then on the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there's more workshops across multiple areas. Future of Data, Container Crash Course, Cybersecurity Summit. You can just literally wander from track to track as it takes your fancy. They're always good. There's lots of interesting information in there. The tracks have been curated by people like us. In particular, the networking track has been curated by Tom Hollingsworth and Stephen Foskett from Tech Field Day. So you know there should be some interesting stuff there. And there's going to be a business hall. So if you want to go down and bash up vendors and get free T-shirts, if that's your particular passion in life, it's not mine. But hey, if you think a free T-shirt brings your life meaning, you can go and get some of those. But please do join us at Interop ITX in May. It's just a few weeks away. Now is your best time to get it done. Use the promo code PacketPushers when you register and you'll get a 20% discount. We want to see you in Vegas, so get on over there.
Go to interopitx.com and reserve your spot. And while you're there, you're invited to a live gathering at the Centrifuge Lounge. This is in the MGM Hotel where Interop ITX is being held. The Packet Pushers are going to be there. Viptela is going to be there. They're sponsoring it. We'll talk about SD-WAN and some networking stuff. There's going to be food, drink, and a lot of fun conversation. This is all happening Monday, May 15th at 6:30 p.m. Greg, we did a Viptela live event at the last Interop, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, the live events are great. I love meeting people. Maybe a couple of beers will help to smooth the conversation.
A little social lubricant never hurts.
That's right. Viptela always throws a great party. So if you're going to be at Interop, make sure you come up. And this bar is right in the same venue. The Interop conference is being held in the MGM Grand, and the Viptela event is going to be held in the Centrifuge, which is a bar right in the middle of the MGM Grand. So really easy to get to. We'd love to see you there.
Yep. Just register at viptela.com/centrifuge. That's viptela.com/centrifuge. And we'll see you in Vegas. All right, back to the news. There's a story about Tanium, a startup. They've been accused by the Wall Street Journal of using a hospital's live network for sales demos, and they may have exposed patient data.
Yeah, this is pretty grim. Now, I think there's going to be a bit of a thread here between this and the next article, but Tanium is one of these venture capital startups that's actually managed to get some good traction.
I think Andreessen Horowitz is a funder.
Yeah, and $3.5 billion is the last valuation. And basically, they've been running fast and loose with customer data. They've been giving demos at a customer site and saying, here's it working in one of our customers. And the customer that they're demoing from never was asked for permission and never realized that their confidential internal network information was basically being shown to other people. Now, in particular, it's healthcare, and that is strictly not acceptable under healthcare law to let data leak out like that. Tanium should never have had access, really. Now, I also note that the apology that came from Tanium didn't actually say, I'm sorry. He says, I wish we had have anonymized the data. In other words, I'll do it again. Did you notice that?
Well, he said they take responsibility for mistakes and they should have done a better job anonymizing customer data, but there was never an I'm sorry.
What he said was the mistake was that I didn't anonymize the customer data, not that I showed a customer's internal network without permission. There's no admission of guilt here, right?
Yes, it is a, I don't want to say brazen, but it doesn't reek of contrition, I would say.
No. So I think this is one of these things. We're starting to see a lot of these aggressive sales cultures. So one of the things that A16Z does to its startups, as soon as they're successful, is absolutely focus on hammering them into selling, right? And it doesn't matter how you sell. It doesn't matter who you kill. It doesn't matter who you piss off. It doesn't matter how many people you crush. as long as you get the deal, right? And this aggressive sales culture, this I'm rich because I'm clever and I'm clever because I'm rich thinking, means that you're just meat to be chewed up, spat out, and stepped on.
Always be closing.
Always be closing, yeah. And this stinks of that, right? A security startup had some good ideas. The company Stanium has actually had a fairly mixed record. It's been like making outrageous claims about how awesome its product is, which are patently false. Its product's not that great. There's plenty of others. And it's probably already obsolete. The industry's moved past it and it's probably already done for. But there are other companies that have done the same sort of thing. So be careful. Watch out for this. You know, if you're talking to somebody who's got this super aggressive sales culture, that's a sign that you've got a company that's distorted in a particular direction and probably not one that's focused on you. They're focused on them, their sales. Yeah.
Good point. All right. And sticking with startups, there's been some kerfuffle in the anti-malware industry. There's a company named Silence. They've been caught in a tiff with testing organizations about the validity of product tests. There's been some accusations back and forth about setting up tests to best benefit each other, blah, blah, blah. Lots of finger pointing.
So Silence is one of these tools about malware detection. You pass files through it, it detects them. And they've been giving customers a sample of 40 pieces of safe malware. They've basically taken this malware and removed the payload and said, look, everybody's system should recognize these 40 pieces of. And funnily enough, Silence's system is the only one to recognize all 40. So somebody reversed all of the code in those and found out that probably 7 of them are actually not malware. There's just specific triggers that nobody will match except Silence because it's in their system, right? So now all of a sudden, Silence is being accused of, you're giving people these things and saying, well, you know, and they don't. The interesting thing about Silence is it's another one of these VC-funded billion-dollar startups with a super aggressive culture, also A16Z, by the way, just make draw your conclusions. Basically, what they're doing is lying to their customers. They're saying, here's 40 pieces of malware. And at some percentage, 5 or more of those pieces of malware out of 40 actually are not malware. They're just triggers that to make Silence look like it's the only company that can do that. They've never submitted their company for third-party independent testing. They'll only do so if they can specify the testing regime that's going to happen. So you draw your conclusions from here. The ARS Technica piece is very good and sort of explains it all out. But just keep in mind, Silence is another company that's been very, very sharp, very aggressive sales behavior. There's a lot of young people thinking they're going to make it rich, and it's probably going to come unstuck doing this.
All right. Our last story for the day is about the chip maker Qualcomm. They put out their most recent financial results. They reported $5.99 billion in revenue for the second quarter financial. That's up 8% versus last year. They also beat analyst expectations. Unfortunately, the company is involved in a $1 billion lawsuit with Apple. Apple's alleging that Qualcomm is way overcharging for patent licenses, and so some uncertainty about this lawsuit has affected their share price.
Nah, 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 nah. But with $1 billion.
Well,
yes,
that's a big stick.
This is really, there's a whole bunch of things going on here. Like Qualcomm, of course, is the company that back in the early 2000s, late 90s, developed the CDMA standard and got the American government, of course, to force the American carriers to use CDMA so that it could make licensing fees out of it. And this is the sort of thing that Qualcomm's done for 20 years. It develops some technology and then traps the market into paying it licensing royalties. And now they're suddenly finding that they're not the big beast here. Apple's much bigger. BlackBerry has taken them down. They've just been on the wrong side of a lawsuit in South Korea. They lost a couple of $100 million in a judgment there.
Yeah, and getting back to BlackBerry real quick, they were in arbitration with BlackBerry again over some royalties, and Qualcomm now has to pay BlackBerry $814 million. This is a binding arbitration, so they can't appeal. They just got to flat out pay it.
Yeah. Don't forget they're now also in a lawsuit with Apple. Apple has been paying Qualcomm licensing fees to use their technology and sometimes blah, blah, blah. Qualcomm has been overcharging them. That is what happened in South Korea. So they've already gone down for it in South Korea. There's a fair bet they're going to lose out with Apple as well. And even worse, Apple's actually paid them for stuff and then Qualcomm refused to do a reverse payment back. So it's not looking good for Qualcomm. It really isn't. So we'll see.
It's going to be a rough few months, perhaps, yes.
Yes, it's hard to see. And I think they're also burning up customer relationships at the same time. Like I said, when you have fairly sharp behavior like this, aggressive sales tactics, it doesn't take long for an Apple particularly to go, you know what, maybe we should just go and do it ourselves.
Apple is not one to poke, I would think.
No. Well, you know, look at what they did with ARM. There was a news case, 2 weeks ago where they had been buying a graphics chip from the chip design from a company. And then they just said, yeah, we're going to make our own now. And that company's gone, right? So I think Qualcomm might have already been written out of the Apple strategy going forward. And they figure there's nothing to lose here, but there's $1 billion on the table that they can grab potentially if they just stick it to them. So see.
I guess. We'll keep an eye on if there are any more developments emerge. We will let you know. But that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
P, you can find me on my blog, Theory on Mind, where I'm microblogging, which is like lots of little pieces, little posts and thoughts and snippets. But mostly I'm blogging long form on packetpushers.net or on the Twitters is at Theory on Mind.
And I would love to connect with you on Twitter. I'm Drew_CM. I also blog at packetpushers.net if you want to read what I write. Thanks to our sponsors, IT Pro TV, Interop ITX, and the Viptela Party at the Centrifuge at the MGM Grand. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or tell your friends about it. Please check out our newsletters. That's the Human Infrastructure Magazine, goes out twice a month, and Link Propagation, which comes out every week. You can find those links to sign up for free at packetpushers.net, along with reams and reams of fine free technical content. Thanks for listening.